I'm Gail Harris in for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Today, the warring parties in Sudan's two-decades-old civil war agreed to sign a peace agreement by the end of the year. But there is another conflict in Sudan, this one pitting rebel black Africans against government forces in Darfur, the western region of the country. BBC correspondent Hillary Anderson went to Sudan, and her powerful documentary, The New Killing Fields, tells the story of a country ravaged by violence, fear, and death. In one village, she found mothers who had buried 80 children killed in a single raid.
We had to block our noses with cotton to stop the smell when we buried the bodies. For 3 days we were carrying the dead to bury them. Their blood dried on my body. There is so much sadness. God forgive me. It would be better to be dead.
An Arab militia group known as the Janjaweed is believed responsible for this killing frenzy, burning black African villages to the ground and forcing nearly 2 million people from their homes. Sudan's government is accused of sponsoring the militia and doing nothing to stop the rampant violence. Do you call this crisis a genocide? Are the UN and Western governments taking appropriate measures to stop the killing? What do you think should be done in Darfur? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And the BBC's Hillary Anderson joins us now from her home in Johannesburg, South Africa. Hillary, welcome.
Thank you.
Let's start with this morning's events. The UN Security Council says it is committed to ending all the violence in Sudan, but there have been other attempts to end the war, and those have failed. Does this agreement offer anything more than what we've seen before?
Well, what's happened today is that the Security Council has passed another resolution demanding an end to the violence in Darfur, demanding an end to the forced removals of civilian refugees from the refugee camps and to abductions and all of that. But the resolution is really fairly weakly worded when it comes to Darfur compared to previous resolutions. For example, there's no specific reference to the need for the Janjaweed to be disarmed, and various other things have been left out, although there are references to previous resolutions. And the long and the short of it is that the Sudanese government has been violating UN Security Council demands and UN resolutions since August. The UN Security Council resolutions have made no difference on the ground that I've been able to see in traveling around Darfur, and so I think the Sudanese government will probably take this latest resolution as a bit of a blank check so that they can continue what they're doing, which is harassing the civilians in the camps, in many cases over the last couple of weeks beating people up. These are civilian refugees. And of course, this all comes in the context of killings that are still going on, massacres that are still happening, particularly in the south of Darfur.
So the agreement seems to be more focused on ending the civil war, which is a northern and southern affair, much less so as to Darfur, which is in the west.
Correct. And to be fair to the Security Council, that's what this meeting of the Security Council in Nairobi was always supposed to be about. Just to be clear for your listeners, there are two wars in Sudan. One is the war in the south, which is basically between Christian and animist black African rebels who have been fighting the Islamic Arab-dominated government for about 20 years. That is a completely separate war from the situation in Darfur, which broke out in February of last year, which also, however, pits black Africans or people who originally come from black African tribes against people who are from Arabic ethnic origins.
I have to ask, how were you able to even make this journey? Certainly the government didn't want you to be there. How were you able to get in there? These areas were off limits.
Well, we were given visas by the Sudanese government to travel to Sudan and to travel to government-held parts of Darfur, which is most of Darfur. But what we did was we wanted to get into some of the no-go areas, which make up huge sections of this vast and really remote Saharan region. And we wanted to get into one of the rebel-held areas in some mountains called Jebel Mara. So to do that, we basically had to we had to, I mean, it took about 2 months to figure out how to do this, but we basically had to go down a dirt road where we couldn't be seen and just slip out of government territory. And it involved driving cross country in areas where there has been a lot of fighting. And there was fighting the day we were driving down there. And it was quite a difficult journey. It was, you know, stopping and starting, trying to assess the safety of going ahead. But like I say, it had been months in the planning, and we had set up, conversations and connections with rebel, Black African rebel commanders, because we were traveling in their territory, so we didn't want to get into trouble with them either. So it was just a question of picking our way forward.
And once you got there, we actually have a clip of one of the stories that you were told. This is about a raid in which many children were killed. Let's listen to that.
The planes were bombing. I told the children to run, but men on horseback and in trucks had already entered the village. I started to shout to my husband to run from the house. They shot him as he stepped from the door. I went back to help him. My son was clinging to my dress. An Arab-looking man in a uniform with military insignia stopped his car next to me. He grabbed my son from me and threw him into a fire.
So many heartbreaking stories that you came across, Hillary. And apparently the way it works is that the Janjaweeds surround these villages and then government planes come in?
Yes, and just to clarify, that clip that you just heard was from a woman called Kalima up in this mountainous area. The 80 children who we documented having been killed in this one town called Kidinir were killed in a series of attacks over a period of about a year and a half. And the attacks have a very clear pattern. What happened to Kidinir is basically what's happening to many, many Black African towns and villages, about 400 of them in Darfur, which is that, as you say, the government planes come in to bomb. Already the Janjaweed militia, who are basically the government's militia, are on the outskirts of the town, usually on camels and horses, and sometimes they have the occasional vehicle. When the bombing tails off, of course, the people, the civilians, are desperately trying to run out of the town. And we did probably 20 hours of interviews with people from the town and basically reconstructed what had happened in Kidinir. As they try to flee the town, those militiamen on the outskirts start closing in on them from all sides, and they shoot. They shoot everybody they see. A lot of the people who were killed in Kidinir were shot in the back as they were trying to run away. A lot of the people killed were children. When the Janjaweed went into the school, into the classrooms, and shot children and women at point-blank range. So that is basically the style of the attacks. And it's significant that they all do have the same pattern, because when it comes to the genocide question, It is the fact that this appears to be systematic, coordinated, and planned killing that matters when it comes to the question of what is and what isn't genocide.
I want to hear from one of our callers now, because Dave from Raleigh, North Carolina, is posing a very interesting question about some of the history here. Dave, I'll let you ask that question yourself.
Hi, well, thanks for taking my call. I'm pretty new to this conflict. I don't know too much about it, and I think my situation is not unlike most Americans. We sort of, you know, see a couple of headlines about these horrific things that are going on in Sudan. And I did not even know there were two different wars and two different conflicts going on until listening to this particular program. But my question is really, what's the historical perspective for the conflict that's going on with what I guess is called the genocide, the Arab government killing all these Christians? I don't really understand. Is it over territory? Is it over religion? Is there an oil component to it? What's at the heart of it?
Well, let me also suggest, Dave, you will really learn a lot from watching Hillary's documentary on this, The New Killing Fields, which you will be able to access through our website. We'll tell you more about that in just a moment. But Hillary, give us a little of the history here.
Well, first of all, this is a very important distinction. The Sudanese war that's been going on for 20 years, let's forget that war for the sake of this discussion, because it's too much to explain. But that is a war basically between Christians and Muslims. Okay, now forget that one. Let's talk about Darfur, which is the more recent war where these systematic killings are going on. Everybody in Darfur is a Muslim. This is not a religious war. It's a very complicated place in terms of the ethnic mix of the people there. Everybody looks black, so it's difficult to say, well, these people are black Africans and these people are Arabs, because there's been intermarriage and so on between the tribes for years and years. But what happened was that in the late 1970s, the Sahara's sand started shifting south with the process of desertification. And a lot of the Arabs, who were nomads mostly, further up north, started moving south trying to find better farmland. And they ended up moving on to lands that were already inhabited by other Arab tribes and had been for hundreds of years, but that were also inhabited by these black African tribes. And remember, Sudan as a whole lies right on this axis between basically sub-Saharan black Africa, shall we say, and North Africa, which is much more Arab and Muslim in its whole look. So we're talking about a sort of major global fault line that runs right through the middle of Darfur, and that is basically what we're seeing, is the rumblings of this fault line. Now, the problem is that the Sudanese government came in when this land issue came up. They weighed in on the side of the Arab nomads who were trying to find land, and that is where the problem begins. Basically, the black Africans of Darfur over a period of years got more and more agitated by the fact that the government was siding with these Arab tribes. And now the tribes had been living peacefully for a long time together in Darfur. For more than 100 years, they'd been intermarrying, sharing schools, and so on. But when the government started backing these Arabs who were trying to get new land because they were fleeing the encroaching deserts, the black people of Darfur got angry, and they started to form a rebel group. And that rebel group, last February 2003, had been organizing itself for a long time and suddenly and unexpectedly launched a massive attack on an airport, a government airport in Darfur. The government was shocked. The rebels, who had really not been heard of very much before at all, took this airport from the Sudanese government, which has one of the biggest militaries in Africa, and effectively were launching an insurrection. Now, the government of Sudan was sitting there thinking, wait a minute, we're about we're on the brink of bringing peace to Sudan, because they were on the brink of a peace accord with these other rebels in the south, on the brink of ending 20 years of war. The last thing they needed was the west of the country, which is Darfur, now getting uppity and trying to secede or to start a whole other war. So they cracked down on these people, and their fatal mistake, because you could argue that this is a legitimate war, but the government's fatal mistake, and it was deliberate, was that they employed the Janjaweed, who were the militias in that area, the Arab militias, and then they basically attacked and killed civilians, systematically killing thousands and thousands of them over that whole period from then until now.
Great history, told very well. It's, as you say, a very complicated story. Just the few seconds we have before we have to take a break, give us a quick line on what Janjaweed means. We see that term a lot. What's the origin of it?
Everyone in Sudan hates the word Janjaweed. Nobody wants to be called one, because it's a play on the Arabic words for horse and evil spirit. And it basically means an evil spirit or a demon on horseback. But what it refers to actually is these militiamen, these tribal militias, who were armed by the Sudanese government in order to burn down the villages and kill the black Africans of Darfur.
We're talking this hour about the crisis in Darfur with my guest, BBC Africa correspondent Hillary Anderson, who has documented the violence there. Should the West classify the killings in Sudan as genocide? And what is the obligation of the world to stop the fighting there? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Gail Harrison for Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. This hour, we're talking to BBC Africa correspondent Hillary Anderson. Over the course of several months this year, she went to Sudan to document the violence there. Close to 2 million people are in refugee camps, and tens of thousands have been killed. U.S. Secretary of State Colin Powell has now called the situation in the Darfur region genocide, but the rest of the world hasn't been anxious to classify it that way. And Hillary, in your documentary, The New Killing Fields, you press the issue several times. I want to first listen to a clip when you confront the British Foreign Office Minister, Chris Mullen.
Killings are going on. Thousands of black Africans have been killed, and you're hesitating to call it genocide.
Well, genocide is not a word that I think should be bandied around lightly for fear of devaluing the term. No one doubts that there have been massive human rights violations, certainly crimes against humanity committed in Darfur.
So, Hillary, why are people reluctant to use the word?
Well, people don't want to devalue a word like genocide. This is a huge word which was created as a result of the Holocaust after the Second World War. And people tend to think of genocide as a question of scale. They think that if something is to be genocide, basically you have to have a situation like Rwanda or the Holocaust where millions of people are killed. That is not the case. The genocide was defined in 1948 very deliberately in a specific way. It was defined as the intention to deliberately destroy in whole or in part an ethnic group. And it was defined that way on purpose, because if you define genocide as mass extermination, then by the time anyone says this is a genocide, everyone's dead and it's too late for anyone to do anything about it. So the point is that for something to be genocide, the perpetrators have to be intending to destroy in whole or in part an ethnic group. And it's fairly clear from traveling around Darfur, and we have talked to many genocide lawyers, me and my team, about how the evidence on the ground in Darfur relates to the actual legal definition of genocide. There is a very strong case legally that genocide is occurring as we speak in Darfur.
I want to hear from Carrie now, who's on the line from Smithfield, North Carolina. Carrie, welcome.
Yes, hi. I want to say how brave and wonderful I think this lady is to have done all this and to have brought it to the world's attention. I'm Jewish, and I take this very personally, and if the world needs my permission to use the term Holocaust, they have my permission. This is Babi Yar and Srebrenica and Rwanda all over again. If the UN does not stop this, the UN should disband, because why else does it exist if it is not to stop things like this? Everyone said in 1945, never again. And look how many never agains there have been. They should be ashamed of themselves. The UN should disband if they don't stop this.
Carrie, I appreciate the call. And Hillary, you know, what is the obligation of the world? If we see genocide happening, who can stop it? What's the obligation here?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the 1948 Genocide Convention does not carry strong legal obligations on the part of the signatories. And Colin Powell pointed that out when he said in one breath, it was extraordinary, when he said in one breath, there is a genocide occurring in Sudan, that is our judgment. And then he said, we shouldn't be distracted by that term. And he went on to basically say that it doesn't really matter whether it's genocide or mass killings or whatever. He was saying, you know, it's all the same thing, and that's all there is to it, which, of course, goes completely against the moral imperative of the 1948 Genocide Convention, which very clearly was written in order to urge action. But legally, and that is significant, legally there are no requirements to act unless genocide is happening on your own soil. So what happens in the end, though, of course, is that politicians get very nervous about using the term, because even though there isn't a legal implication, a strong legal implication to act, they know that there's a political and a moral imperative and that people will start agitating for something to be done.
Well, you spoke to the Sudanese foreign minister, and he said it was not genocide, that Americans were using that word to politicize the issue. And you also confronted him about who was responsible for these raids. I want to play that clip, and then we'll talk about it.
Who has done this? Who has committed these atrocities?
Yeah, that's a good question. First of all, the government never initiated this war. The rebels, who are not denying it, they are the one who initiated this war and insist on continuation of this war.
But who burnt the villages down and killed the people? That's what I'm asking. I'm not following your answer. It's extremely...
What I am saying to you, that it is a tribal fighting. The rebels who are belong to specific tribes, fighting a militia who are also belong to specific tribes. The fighting between each other creates this chaos.
So Hillary, his position seems to be, hey, you know, tribal fighting, not our problem.
Yeah, well, they like to bamboozle the world with the complications of Darfur and try to pretend that this is simply a tribal chaotic kind of situation, which no one should bother about. But the problem with their argument is that hundreds of testimonies from people who have been in these villages have cataloged the style and the nature of these attacks that we were talking about earlier, where you have the government and the Janjaweed working in tandem in a coordinated way, and the fact that what has happened to these 400 villages is virtually identical in every case. And so the killings are systematic and they're coordinated and they're being perpetrated by the government of Sudan. Tribal chaos is not what this is.
1-800-423-8255 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. To Concord, Massachusetts now, we want to hear from Bruce. Hello, Bruce, and welcome.
Hi. I remember about 6 months ago, the Senate passed a resolution declaring what happened in Darfur a genocide. I don't really understand why we're debating the point. Isn't the Senate kind of the ultimate foreign policy arm in our government?
So what the basic question then is, why is nothing happening?
Yeah, well, kind of both. Why isn't the Senate resolution an end? We can all say that the United States has declared this a genocide, and then why aren't we acting on this in our country?
Hillary,
well,
what do you think?
Can I come in here? Well, the reason that no action is being taken is because the legal requirements for action are in the 1948 Genocide Convention are very minimal. There is no debate. The United States has declared this genocide. Other nations haven't. Britain hasn't. The European Union hasn't. The United Nations, crucially, hasn't. 2 years after the killings began, they have just begun an inquiry into whether or not this is genocide. And that is extremely significant because after the Rwandan genocide happened, the world stood up, Kofi Annan stood up and said, this must not happen again. Rwanda could have been stopped if we had acted at the time and if we had defined it as genocide early on. In fact, as he was saying that, it was when Darfur's killings were at their height and UN hadn't even started an investigation yet into whether or not there was a genocide going on there. So their words really were fairly meaningless, and the importance of that is what kind of precedent this sets for Africa, because if the genocide continues to be allowed to happen in Darfur, which it will be, because the international position is that it's a diplomatic pressure will be exerted, but not much else. If that continues in Darfur, what does that mean for places like Rwanda and Burundi in the future, where every 10 years or so there is an eruption of terrible and deliberate ethnic killings?
Well, and also, as you point out in the documentary, with these villages being wiped out, anyone who survives is now off to a refugee camp, and conditions are pretty horrific there as well.
Right, and the refugee camp problem is getting worse and worse. There are now an estimated 2 million people in camps, either in Sudan itself or across the border in Chad. A few months ago, it was estimated 1 million people. So the problem's getting worse, and the world is spending millions and millions, which are desperately needed, to feed these people and to try to stop them from dying. 10,000 people are dying a month, many of them in these camps. But the problem is that just by throwing humanitarian aid at the problem, that doesn't solve the roots of the problem, because the people are continuing to flood into the camps. And the reason they're flooding in is because the killings, the massacres are still going on. And what we've seen happen in the last over the last year is massive international diplomatic pressure on the Sudanese government, but really nothing else. And the Sudanese government seems to be realizing that the diplomatic pressure doesn't mean that much, because at the end of the day, China and Pakistan are going to veto any UN resolution which imposes sanctions on them, and they're basically doing what they want.
Tell us the story about Nadia.
Nadia is a little girl who I met in June in a camp called Mornay, which was a camp for about 80,000 people in West Darfur, and she had stumbled into the camp being carried by her mother, Juma. Their village had been attacked. Many of their family members had been killed, and their story was not unusual. But Nadia, when we met her in June, was very, very frail, and she was basically in extreme pain because she was starving to death very slowly and painfully. And it was at the time the rains were about to start, and in the evenings, although this is the Sahara and it's very hot in the day, the temperature drops a little bit in the evenings. What that means for the children who are starving, because when you starve, it's not about being hungry. In fact, if you're starving, you really can't eat because you've become so weak. The children couldn't cope with these tiny drops in the temperature, but Nadia was pulling through, and she was actually recovering. We finished our trip, went away, and came back a month later, and we went back to the same tent where she was. And amazingly, she was still there, because usually they move the kids out after a couple of days if they've survived and put them back into the camps after their emergency treatment. But Nadia was actually in the process of dying the minute we walked into that camp. She died about 7 minutes later, and her mother was sitting next to her in this awful scene, with her head bowed, and the child had basically contracted an infection of her lungs. She was too weak to fight that infection, and so she was buried that day. These are Muslims, so the tradition is that you bury the dead immediately. And we watched as this tiny body was lowered into the ground, you know, in this kind of bizarre, remote, austere setting that Darfur is. And you know, we were seeing this happening in June and July. It's still happening now, almost daily. I mean, you could, from where we were sleeping just next to the tent where Nadia and the other children were, we could hear the mothers screaming every night, because every night at least one child in that tent would die. And you get to the point where you watch another 2-year-old being buried, and that is what happens every day.
Well, as you see this every day, does it make you all the more determined to get this story out?
Of course it does, yes, because, you know, on a personal level, it's obviously extremely difficult to watch children dying, and it is mostly the children because they're the most vulnerable and the weakest. And I think, you know, the point about Darfur is that it's not just another complicated, nasty African war. It's not a complicated tribal war. It's very, very simple, and it's very distinctive. It's a government of a country deliberately killing a certain color and type of person, which are the black Africans of Darfur. And that is why what is happening there looks like genocide. And genocide is something that stands out as the ultimate crime against humanity. It's not a war crime. It goes way beyond that. And genocide matters, because if genocide doesn't, then what does, quite honestly?
1-800-423-8255 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. We're going to Thomas now, who's on the line from Nidell, North Carolina. Hi, Thomas.
Hey, my name is Thomas Mabiala. I'm from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and I have participated in many efforts to make crimes known here in America, to advocate for people who are being killed all over the world. I admire what the sister has done to help people in Darfur, to make the genocide known all over the world. My concern is that in the Congo, in my country, although it's not the subject, 3,700,000 people have died, have been killed in a civil war imposed by neighboring country, and the world has paid no attention at all. The world only talks about the one that took place in Rwanda in 1995, but there's no talk about 3,700,000 people killed every day, and they continue to die as we speak, and nobody ever talks about it. So I don't know which level, what are the parameters, what needs to be done for certain countries to have their genocide spoken about. That's my concern. It breaks my heart. 3,700,000 people have been killed nowadays in these years. It is happening, and nobody talks about it, and these are reports from the United Nations where I work it myself. So it's really troubling, and we don't know why is it that some countries got their situation reported about, and some other countries, nobody ever even mentioned anything.
Thomas, thank you for the call, and no question, it's breaking a lot of hearts. And Hillary, you've been the Africa correspondent there for quite some time. I mean, there is, as you look at it over the decades, there does seem to be a tipping point, you know, that things have to get so horrific that finally the rest of the world begins to pay attention. And presumably, at some point, something gets done about it.
Well, you know, basically you're faced with difficult choices in Africa about what to cover, because you can't be everywhere at once. And the situation in the Congo is absolutely horrific. And we've been covering it bit by bit over the years as it's developed. I suppose the answer as to why Darfur has gained so much media attention this year and international attention is because the nature and style of the killings are ethnic, which does potentially make it genocide, and genocide is something that stands out as far worse than everything else. But we're talking about a sort of awful, you know, debate about what kind of killing is worse. I mean, it's a very difficult terrain. The question about what the world should be doing about Africa's problems is an absolutely gigantic question, and one of the ways forward is the idea of regional peacekeeping. And the African Union troops have been sent into Darfur to do something about it. It's almost a test case. Well, it is a test case for whether Africa can try to solve its own problems in the lack, particularly at the moment, of fashionability of Western intervention, what with all that's going on in Iraq. Now, the problem is that the African Union experiment in Darfur really isn't working, and that is primarily because the troops there don't have a mandate to protect the people. They have a mandate to monitor and observe ceasefire violations, which amounts to basically standing around, to be honest, standing around, building your tents, going out on little patrols where you take notes about what's happened after killings have taken place. They have no mandate whatsoever that enables them to actively protect the people, unless the violence happens to occur right in front of their eyes, which, as we saw last week when the Sudanese police went into a refugee camp, tried to move the people out, started beating up old people, shipping women off, taking them away from their children. The African Union troops, armed men, were just down the road. They didn't have a mandate to do anything about it. So I think what is needed is a huge amount of international pressure to give these men the mandate they need to try to protect the civilians of Darfur.
Well, in just a couple of seconds before we have to take a break, those troops that you interviewed seemed very frustrated about all of that.
They're deeply frustrated. A lot of these people are professional peacekeepers who've worked in other places where they've had proper mandates to do something to protect the people. That's what they don't have in Darfur.
They would rather stop it if they could, but they don't have the power at this point. We'll pick up on that point when we come back in just a moment. We're talking this hour with BBC Africa correspondent Hilary Anderson about her new documentary, The New Killing Fields. What can the international community do to stop the killing in Darfur? Should the United States or the United Nations or someone else send in troops? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK if you'd like to join the conversation. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. I'm Gail Harris. This is The Connection. This hour, we are talking about the crisis in Sudan with BBC Africa correspondent Hilary Anderson. Hilary just completed work on a BBC documentary, The New Killing Fields, that documented widespread murder and destruction in Sudan. The question now is, how should the world respond? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And I want to hear from another clip, Hilary, from your documentary. This was from your mission to track down one of these suspected Janjaweed leaders, Musa Hilal. Tell us a little bit about him, and then we want to hear the clip.
Well, he's a 43-year-old man from an Arab tribe in the north of Darfur. His tribe is one of the tribes that came down in the late 70s from more northerly reaches down into more southerly parts of Darfur and onto lands that were farmed by black Africans, which was the source of tensions between the groups. His men were the kind of people who were ultimately armed by the Sudanese government, and the Sudanese government employed these men with the very important help of Musa Hilal to put down this black African uprising that started at the beginning of last year. And his men are absolute killers. They're thugs. They've carried out atrocities that have been documented.
Well, it's remarkable that you were able to speak with him. Let's hear a bit of that.
You stand accused of mass killings, of ordering men to carry out atrocities, including rape. What do you say to that charge?
This is like every war. Every war has its repercussions. America itself has had wars, and there are criminals from those wars. We are not angels or prophets or magicians, so we can't arrest all the criminals and stop them from committing their crimes. Where are the graves and the bodies? Yet there is killing in this war, but it's exaggerated.
Hillary, how did you find him?
Easy. He's sitting in his house in the middle of Khartoum, which is Sudan's capital, which goes to show that nobody's trying to arrest him, least of all the government that has been arming him, the Sudanese government. And yet here he is. He's on the State Department's list. He's the number one on their list of suspected Janjaweed leaders, and nothing is being done about him, which just goes to highlight the fact that what is happening in Darfur, the mass ethnic killings that are still going on now are known about. They've been documented. Everyone knows who's behind it. And basically, it's allowed to go on, which is fairly extraordinary given the scale of the killings.
And no question about where he's getting the guns. He's getting them from the government.
Well, he denies that, and the Sudanese government denies having anything to do with the Janjaweed, but it's all a semantic wiggle around the word Janjaweed, because nobody likes to be called a Janjaweed, because in the context of Darfur, it means the people, the men who've carried out the atrocities. But we really uncovered that whole link, if there was any question about it, which there wasn't for anyone who knows Darfur, between the government and the Janjaweed. And what we did was we got Musa Hilal's cousin to take us to his tribal territory, and they agreed to this because they wanted to prove to us that there were no problems, no tribal problems in Darfur. So we went on this extraordinary journey past sort of, you know, lots and lots of burnt out black African villages with this guy saying, this is a happy, peaceful place. And anyway, we got him to take us down to a particular town called Misteriha, where it is known that there is a, well, basically the town acts as a base for 900 Janjaweed fighters. When we went into the market, we found the Janjaweed men wore government uniforms. And when we started talking to them, they quite happily showed us their government identity cards. So they're obviously not as attuned as the politicians are to the need to sort of hide the connection between the government and the Janjaweed. But it's all clear and it's there to be seen. And it's also simple to glean from the testimonies of the thousands and thousands of people who have fled attacks that are coordinated between the government and these Janjaweed militias.
I want to hear from another caller now. Phil's on the line from the Adirondacks of New York. Hi, Phil, and welcome.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to thank Ms. Anderson for her diligent effort to bring this horror to the forefront. I'm aware of her efforts. Ms. Anderson?
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Could you give the listeners an idea of how much economic and military dollars of U.S. taxpayer money goes to Sudan, and how to bring about or apply pressure on the United States government and other governments, for that matter, to end any aid until the genocide stops? I'll take your answer off the air, and thank you very much again.
Okay, thank you for those comments. I don't have the American figure to hand, but I can tell you that America is spending huge amounts on trying to help feed the people in Sudan, and it's an appalling thought to suggest cutting off the aid. That is not the answer, as far as I'm concerned. The people who are the victims of this are the people in the camps who are only alive because they get food aid and medical aid from countries like the United States, which is a very, very important player on the humanitarian front in Sudan. Having said that, it's like putting a Band-Aid on a big gaping wound, and the wound is sort of constantly being gouged, and it's being gouged by the fact that the killings are continuing to go on. So the humanitarian aid is doing a huge amount to help Darfur, but more needs to be done, and what needs to be done is that at the very least you need some kind of peacekeepers in there, international peacekeepers who can actually keep the peace, as opposed to just taking notes on ceasefire violations and cataloging how many people have been killed after it's happened.
To Charles now, who's on the line from Greenville, North Carolina. Hello, Charles.
Hi, ma'am. Miss Anderson?
Yes.
Hello?
Hi there.
Yes, I'm from Rwanda, originally a refugee in Uganda. I do really appreciate what exactly you're doing. It's more of a comment that I want to make. Mm-hmm. It hardens my heart right now to think of every time we have a problem in Africa, that we have to call on the Europeans, you know, the British, the Americans, and all that. What do you think, I mean, what does it have to take for Africans to take charge of our own problems?
Well, there are Rwandan soldiers in Darfur right now as part of, in fact, they make up half of the African Union peacekeeping mission there, and it's really significant that it's Rwanda because, as you'll know, your president, President Kagame, has made a clear statement to being committed to trying to stop genocides anywhere else they happen in the world. And Rwanda, of course, is one of the poorest countries on earth, and yet there they are with their soldiers being paid $2 a day trying to do what they can. But the fact is that the African Union operation there is massively underfunded. It's not particularly well organized. And most importantly, they do not have the mandate to do what is needed to stop the killings. And I'm sure you're familiar with those kind of words after the horrors of what happened in your country 10 years ago.
Charles, thanks for the call. And to that point, Hillary, you know, it's tempting to say, well, let's send in troops from the West. But would that exacerbate the situation? Is it better to have troops on the ground there who are part of the African Union and just change the mandate, send more of them, and make sure they have the power to actually do something?
Well, first of all, no one is suggesting sending troops from the West. No governments are interested in doing that right now. So we can talk about it till kingdom come, but the fact is no one wants to do that. Now, should they want to do it? Is it a good idea? Well, I think that it is true and fair to say that following Iraq and particularly Abu Ghraib and all of that, you know, African countries have a certain distaste, particularly for American intervention of any kind, and especially a Muslim government like the government of Sudan. And I would say that's understandable distaste because the United States is no longer seen as it used to be as a neutral broker in these situations. A huge amount of damage has been done to America's reputation as do-gooders in the world as a result of what happened at Abu Ghraib and what's been happening in Iraq. So that's a big problem. And I think that that doesn't rule out the possibility of some kind of international force, but I think it would need to be a force that went in under the auspices of the United Nations. So that's the answer to that, but also regional peacekeeping, in other words, the Africans doing it themselves, is an idea that's widely supported. It's supported by the U.S., it's supported by Europe and Britain, and it's a great idea because Africa wants to look after its own problems as well. The thing is how to make it work. I think it needs the way it's happening now in Darfur is really a bit of an underfunded, not very well thought out experiment in regional peacekeeping. These guys need to go in with experienced UN peacekeepers at their side, giving them logistical help and assistance. They need backup, they need more money, and crucially, they need that mandate.
We were talking a moment ago about the situation in the camps, and I just wanted to get back to that for a second because you would think of a camp as being a place of refuge, as difficult as the living situations are there. But I understand one of the problems is that the food aid that comes in has to be cooked, which means people have to then go outside the camps to get firewood. And when they do that, and these are particularly women, they get attacked.
Yeah, I mean, these are not refugee camps of any kind of refugee camp I've ever seen before anywhere in the world. These are basically prison camps, giant open-air prison camps. People cannot go out of the camps safely at all. There's basically invisible fences running around the camps, which are usually what they call wadis, which are dry riverbeds. Everybody knows exactly the perimeters beyond which they can go. If the women go out, they get raped. If the men go out, they get killed. And so the women go out because that's considered less bad. And when they get raped, they're gang raped. It's almost always gang rape. And as you were explaining, they go out because they have to go out. They have to get firewood. Otherwise, they can't eat their food aid. They can't cook. They can't live. And even the aid that they've got isn't enough to get by with. So they have to go out of these camps. So you see them usually at dawn in the mornings kind of creeping out of the camps, you know, going to collect whatever firewood they can, coming back. Not everyone gets caught, but people get raped every single day. Many, many people are being raped all over Darfur. Nobody knows how many people have been raped, but I can tell you that you can walk into any refugee camp anywhere in Darfur, and if you Just start asking anyone, is there anyone here who's been raped? Within 5 minutes, you will be surrounded by a throng of women wanting to tell their stories. I mean, it is extraordinary. There must be thousands and thousands of people who have been raped, and the rape is horrific. It's not even, it is gang rape. It's extremely brutal. You know, people die. There's no medical aid. It's truly one of the most horrific sides to what is happening in Darfur. And I want to stress again that this is happening now. It's happening right now as we speak. It's not something that was happening. It's something that is happening, and it'll happen next week. It'll happen the week after. It'll probably be happening 6 months down the line, because basically all the world is doing is exerting diplomatic pressure on Sudan to stop this, and the diplomatic pressure is not working.
Well, what might?
Well, trying to give the African Union troops there a proper mandate where they can protect the people, where they can intervene. Soon there are going to be 3,000 African Union men there. They're going to be armed. You know, they're international forces. But why are they there if they can't protect the people properly? So I think someone needs to have a big argument with the Sudanese government about these troops' mandates. The international community needs to say to Sudan, these men are going to have a mandate to protect the civilians. That needs to be the international position. And there's the possibility of unilateral sanctions. If sanctions aren't possible through the United Nations, then there's nothing stopping the United States or any European countries or anyone for that matter from imposing their own sanctions on the leaders of the country that are doing this. There are measures that can be taken, and at the moment, the threats just aren't really having an impact. And one thing that has worked and has been achieved by the diplomatic pressure is that the food aid, was finally allowed in, the food and medical aid, which had initially been blocked during the first few months of this crisis. That worked. The Sudanese government let the food in as a direct result of diplomatic pressure. But that's where it ended. And the question now is a question of security, because unless you secure the countryside and stop the killings, the people are going to keep coming into these camps, and the world's going to have to keep paying to feed these people, and the people will keep dying in the camps because the camps are appalling places. So the whole thing spirals from the fact that no one is really doing anything proactive to stop the killings.
Well, your work certainly did, and we thank you very much for it and for being our guest.
Thank you.
Hilary Anderson is BBC Africa correspondent. Her documentary, The New Killing Fields, aired on the BBC this week. If you'd like to learn more about what you can do and also to watch Hilary Anderson's documentary, please visit our website, www.theconnection.org. The Connection is produced by Jennifer Ehrlich, Catherine Fellarosa, Jen Mattson, Virginia Prescott, Christina Russo, Doug Shugarts, and Kevin Sullivan. Our interns are Sarah Baker, Diana Schoding, and Jillian Nolan. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Gail Harris, and for Dick Gordon, this is The Connection.